we were talking about that
Pop Buell.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked me if mm-hmm. I knew what Pop Buell was doing mm-hmm. in northern Laos, and I think what Pop Buell was doing in northern Laos, aside from whatever medical thing he was doing, was mm-hmm. organizing counterinsurgency.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
The question is, what is counterinsurgency? If it's supplying arms
mm-hmm.
and organizing militia units,
mm-hmm.
actually, I don't know the answer to that question as far as Pop Buell's concerned.
It certainly
that was happening there. The question was, and this applies to IBS, does nation building count as counterinsurgency? And the issue is that an issue you and Michael might have addressed, and I'd like you to talk about if you can, is were you aware of the fact that you were doing what are known as nation building elements? That is, by providing services, essentially through the Pathet Lao government or as representatives of the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
you were winning the loyalty of people for the Royal Lao government
right.
and away from another group. But the other group, of course, was it's a neutralist government. And in other words, the Pathet Lao and the Royal Lao government were supposed to be on the same side, that is, legally. And you felt that IBS was standing on one side. Was that your impression? That is, you were trying to build support for the Royal Lao government, which you believe was favoring U.S. interests in Southeast Asia?
Okay, what I believed we were doing was was working in community development outside of that dualism,
mm-hmm.
outside of that dualistic view of Pathet Lao or Royal Lao allegiances.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not until the issue of our becoming, of IVS people becoming the target of violence and assassination that we were forced to look at the fact that we might not, that was just our idea of what we were doing and not necessarily what was perceived by anyone else. And at that point it became an ethical problem. I think that we had ignored the ethical implications of our role there until that point.
Well, Fred seemed to suggest, he said, what was interesting is that in Vietnam, in 67, there was a Don Lu circulated that letter. There was essentially a revolt. People left. You know, not everyone, but a large
mm-hmm.
group of people left. And that never happened in Laos, in the sense that there was this mass moment. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it was easy to retain retain the feeling that you were doing something useful and you were beyond that other dimension. And I think that that's impossible.
It was impossible for you.
Yeah, it was impossible for me at a certain mm-hmm. point, but mm-hmm. I certainly attempted to live with that fiction as long as possible because
mm-hmm.
it was so wonderful to be there and it seemed so important to be there. And I think it was important in terms of, I think important for me. I don't know that I ever contributed anything to anyone there. So, in fact, it seems that it was a very egotistical exercise. And none of us were outside of the actual participation in the war, no matter what did you think of the?
I mean, there were probably, and I haven't talked to one of them yet, but there were probably people in Laos then with IVS volunteers who were capable of saying, "Hey, you're giving us a choice.
Mm-hmm.
We either face up to what you perceive as reality and leave." or we become part of the war by staying. And we reject that. We reject that dichotomy that you're creating,
mm-hmm.
that it's better, even if there is a war going on, to provide these services and to continue this human connection. Right. Then just walk away.
Right.
Did you encounter that argument?
I didn't encounter that argument. Right. I wish I had, because I think that that's got a lot of validity to it.
What kind of arguments did, when Michael was saying what we need to do is get out, everyone didn't get out.
No.
Why?
Nobody got out.
Well, why did you think that? Why did you think that nobody left? What do you think was their rationale then? What did you presume was their rationale for staying?
Well, I can only presume that they felt that what they were doing was more important than why they might have been perceived to be doing it. That what they were doing was valuable and that the war was an extra, that they could continue their work and maybe have a positive impact besides anything to do with the war.
Do you think that many wanted to stay because they thought that
I think they wanted to stay because they wanted to stay. Which is exactly why I wanted to
stay. Oh, yes, that's why you wanted to stay. But you were married.
I was married.
Yes, what a traditional problem. Mm-hmm. But let's say if you weren't married and you weren't living with your husband.
I would have probably stayed.
You probably would have stayed.
Yes, definitely.
And more because you felt that it was something productive for you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know I felt, and I still do feel, that the friendships and the relationships that I had there were important, for whatever reason. I wonder about what happened to those people after we left, and whether their friendships with me put them in jeopardy. But at the time, I never considered that that was something that would be a problem.
Several people felt that way.
Yeah.
Do you think that there were many people who wanted to stay because they actually believed in the war effort? That they believed.
I would be surprised if that's the case. I would really be surprised.
Yeah. There was an article. I'll send a copy to you. An article called "The Reluctant Counterinsurgents."
Mm-hmm.
It was in a book published by Alfred McCoy, who didn't like the war effort in Laos about Hmong, with just a bunch of heroin dealers. And it's a long story. But Nina Adams and Alfred McCoy did this book. And there's an article by John Whelan, a chapter in the Whelan called it Reluctant Counterinsurgents. Mm-hmm. And essentially, it wasn't that everything in that article isn't true to some extent, but it's everything is boosted up to its implication, the way hard copy would look at something.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, nation building is counterinsurgency. Therefore, digging wells is part of a counterinsurgency.
Mm-hmm.
And that IVSers wanted to be in Laos for more noble reasons, but many of them felt that the war effort was good anyway. Communism was bad, and that the work they were doing would make friends for America, and making friends for America wasn't bad. And the point is, I haven't had a single person say anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Fred repeated something that Llewellyn says, which was that the CIA used the IBS as cover. And I simply asked him, do you know one person who was CIA in IBS? And he said, no.
No.
He said, it's just hearsay. He says, I knew it was a rumor even then.
But, there's another way in which the CIA could have used IVS as cover, simply because we were in place and we were visible, and so CIA people could move around the countryside with less suspicion, because there were other of Caucasians in the countryside that were not suspected.
Who were not armed.
Right, no. Exactly. And so I think that that's very plausible, actually, because it just set up a situation where there were people all over the place in these little villages, mm-hmm. these North Americans, mm-hmm. and CIA people and others could come and visit or move through, and mm-hmm. and they were acceptable. They weren't really remarked.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't sound that strange.
No, it's not strange. But it, you know, to me it doesn't add up to what... Anyway, I'll send you a copy of this article, uh-huh. and I'd be interested in your impressions.
Yeah, it doesn't add up to what he said.
It just doesn't add up to a program.
No,
And the implications is clear. And, of course, the implications occurred to you. That was why you and Michael left.
That's why,
yeah. Exactly. And that's I think that's important, and that's why we're here talking.
Yeah.
And, but it was so amazingly, this article seemed so amazingly simplistic and not trying to live within this complexity that we're talking about. I have yet to meet an IBSer who, although everyone was kind of banned from proselytizing, had any religious zeal. Even those who went on to work for USAID in Laos, even the word of them was meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were working like Alan Beery.
Right.
You know, they were working in Laos doing what they thought was good work, and Galen was working as administrative assistant to mm-hmm. Pop Buell.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that there were CIA guys everywhere and that there was this horrendous war going on in Laos, but the forward action teams were just essentially IVS units of USAID in less secure areas.
Yeah.
But nothing else differed.
Right.
Forward action teams in this article sound like A-teams.
Uh-huh.
You know, what was your impression? I mean, you had a kind of recovery there of what was your impression of what the forward action teams were? Do you think they had anything to do with IBS?
Oh, I think that they had not much to do with IBS. Yeah, I think that they were just a way of infiltrating areas, a way of being there. And I think as things heated up and got more and more intense, there was just a general knowledge that all of that was happening without, and all you had to do was kind of eavesdrop on your radio receiver, mm-hmm. and there was just so much traffic going north and coming south, and there were, if you needed an aircraft and you could call one in, you might walk into any kind of situation. And we did on occasion with very strange people in these aircraft. And ordinarily it'd just be villagers all
mm-hmm.
being moved from one place to another to market or something, or soldiers. But oftentimes it was very mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there was just a general environment of warfare and a kind of nobody said anything, nobody... Mm-hmm. Nothing really was out front.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as IVSers, we really didn't have much access to any news media.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we really didn't know, except from a kind of feeling of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't really know what was going on. There was no way to check information.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much information. I don't think we got a newspaper.
Well, in Vientiane and other areas, of maybe Pakse or something, but people were told, you know, if they mentioned it, you know, what's going on in this war in Laos, they said, well, you're not supposed to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
The IVS actually told them that, you know, it just had nothing to do with what they were doing.
Well, we didn't even know what was happening in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
really, except
mm-hmm.
that there was a war happening and
mm-hmm.
they were bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Ho Chi Minh Trail was also in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And so we knew that they were bombing in Laos.
Mm-hmm. Well, the joke was that the only secret war in Laos was secret was to the State Department, because the CIA wouldn't tell them. But that anyone who was there knew that there was a war in Laos.
Of course, we knew
there
was a war in Laos.
So, your husband must have had a 2-year commitment because of the CO status. What happened because he terminated the...
What happened was that he ended up working as a night janitor in Highland Hospital in Oakland.
kind of like Richard Dreyfuss.
Is that so?
County General in L.A.
That's what he did for another year to fulfill his commitment.
And what happened then?
And then during that period of time, we had a daughter born. She was, and then we, after his commitment was over, we moved to Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning of living in small towns.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a much smaller town. And we lived there for quite a long time.
And you worked on?
Didn't work.
You didn't work?
No. Mm-hmm. He worked, and I raised three children. We raised three children.
Three children?
Mm-hmm.
What did he work at?
He worked as a gardener, and which is the work I do now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the nursery.
No, well, he worked in nurseries, right? Mm-hmm. We worked in nurseries, and but I'm a landscape contractor.
Oh.
That's what I do.
And what were your feelings about what happened in Laos ultimately? Did you ever keep in touch with that?
Well, I kept in touch with. Actually, even to this day, I have remained in touch with one other volunteer with whom I was trained and went to Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't keep in touch. Not really. There was no way to communicate with the people I left behind that were Lao people.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really keep in touch with many of the IVS's either.
When there was an IVS Alumni Association that started, did you join in that? Or?
Yeah, I joined, but I never went to anything because it was all back east. And so I, at that time, now it would be different, but at that time I wasn't able to travel. So we were not active in that at all.
That's interesting. So all the people we're interviewing are people who are on the Alumni Association list at one time or another, or are people who alumni tell us about that we find. And it's interesting, because there must be a lot of people who dropped out and who don't know we're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a shame, because you don't want an oral history selection to be self-selective.
Right.
We're only looking at the people who...
Well, I was wondering if you might not want to talk to my husband, actually.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, because
he
lives in Salinas.
He lives in Salinas?
Mm-hmm.
Are you divorced?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But what is his name?
Mark McDonald.
No, that was stupid.
Of course, I will give you his phone number. You can call him in the morning if you like.
Yeah, there's a possibility that I could see him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how, but I do have to come home one day.
He's very much of a dropout type, so he'd be one of the ones we didn't keep in touch in anyway.
Okay, great. Okay. And my alternative is to go to Reno to see Tom Malia.
Mm-hmm.
And the Reno just looks like a bridge too far right now, but as long as the tape is running. When Laos became a communist country, did you have any feelings or?
Yeah, I actually felt glad in a way that the Americans were out. Mm-hmm. I felt that we were changing things so much, and that I guess the sort of the tipping point for me was the Japanese influence in the dam that I mentioned earlier, and the kind of commercial entry into Laos, I felt, was changing village life so radically. I was actually not sorry that the pace of change had slowed when the communists actually took over.
Of course, they had their own insane little visions about what peasants were.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the parallel with Tanzania.
Right.
That all the communists in Tanzania said, we were nuts. We were running around telling peasants how they should live, and they should live this way, and they should farm this way. And that was the opposite of what the revolution was about.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that might have happened in Laos, too. I don't know. There's so little information that comes out of there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but I wasn't sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Only because the alternative to me seemed to be... it seemed like the alternative was that Laos would become annexed to Thailand, Laos would be annexed to Vietnam, and I thought of the two probably, it would save the culture to become annexed to Vietnam in relation to the political system.
Mm-hmm. Well, being that you're a landscape architect and you actually value real things, and still and all, is there an argument that in itself, that attitude in itself, and the secretary totally disavows any connection with this particular point that I'm about to make, but that there's a kind of missionary zeal attached to the idea of saying, well, at least it saved their culture, whereas perhaps maybe the people would rather be free and lose their culture than be, I don't know, enslaved isn't the right word, but live under an oppressive government that didn't do anything for them, but that process actually preserved their traditions. I mean, obviously that's a...
Missionary zeal. Well, this is a very complex, that's a very complex sentence you made there. Missionary zeal? I don't know if I would call it that. I think it's definitely a choice, you know. It is definitely taking sides about a culture, making a decision that obviously is not mine to make about how culture, you know, how cultures evolve and change. I do think, though, that I do think that the reason that a person like me goes to live in another country and work there is because they want to immerse themselves in a way of life, experience an entire world, and to have, as an American, one's own world kind of trailing behind like a kite string, and seeing how it sort of filtered into so many places and changed them so powerfully, to me is very painful. It's a very painful part of my, contemporary understanding of the world is just that, how American and capitalist and culture has just sort of dyed the entire world the color of itself in large measure. So yeah, I have a point of view. I don't know if I'd call it missionary zeal, but I always did have the same point of view when I was in Southeast Asia and when I was in South America.
Well, of course, you could argue that everyone in Southeast Asia, they would say the same thing, which is, the president of Singapore said this many, many times, which is that there are many valuable things in the West, but we still want to maintain our own identity. And the problem is that the engines of change don't let that happen.
Right.
I think the other thing maybe about the IBS experience is that how can our culture grow and develop? All cultures have roots in other cultures. So how can we continue to develop when we eliminate all the other cultures, which can give us and enable us to continue to enrich ourselves, and instead we become homogenous in our world outlook, and then limited, because what I find the interesting thing about today is that every single person that's interviewed who's an expert will say the same thing, which is about death penalty, abortion, anything like that, will say, of course, these are only treating the symptom. There are underlying problems that these things represent that nobody's doing anything about. And we seem to export not just our culture, but the problems with our culture. And we haven't devised any solutions to those problems or even able to look at them ourselves. but we're giving them to other people.
Right, we're in incredible denial about the problems of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much easier to just, you know, treat these eruptions mm-hmm. as isolated emergencies than I felt when Vietnam and Laos, in effect, were the victors in that funny, ugly, dirty war, that if they bought time for themselves, on the planet, And who's to say, really, you know, ultimately, whether, in fact, you know, some societies will actually survive because they're that isolated by their government.
Of course, that isolation is now coming to an end, one way or the other.
Certainly.
Relatively soon.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can pick this up. That was 1975.
Mm-hmm.
Did you or your husband participate in any anti-war groups or try to express to others the experiences you had and lost?
Yeah, we did that a lot. We moved to the country, and we really took up a lifestyle that was pretty private.
Mm-hmm.
But we made no secret of our views, and we were involved, you know, in our community. We lived in a small town. We talked about Laos, we talked about the war, but no, we weren't politically active outside of that, our own social environment.
Mm-hmm. Have any of your children gone on to any kind of international activities?
No, my children have not.
What are they up to?
I have a daughter who lives close by, who is a single mom. That was the first daughter born, and a son who lives in Santa Fe and is working on at Los Alamos on the International AIDS Database.
Mm-hmm.
He was a student at St. John's College, hoping to come back to Berkeley to graduate school, and a young daughter in Eugene, Oregon, who is probably going to become a librarian.
Yay! Uh-huh.
So, I don't know. I think that my children value, our children value the international experience that we mm-hmm. had, and yet none of them have shown signs of being interested in that.
Mm-hmm. Chris Jenkins has a daughter whose wife is Vietnamese, and the daughter did an oral history with her mom, and as part of that, the parents discovered that the child was always impressed by the commitment
mm-hmm.
the parents had to what they had done and what they were doing and what they would continue to do mm-hmm. in their lives, and that sense of commitment, you know, impressed them, it meant something to them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, what people of our generation always say about the next one is that they seem to lack any sense of commitment. They have no challenge, you know, no one's threatening them in for the single issue which mm-hmm. they can all rally around or gain
their identity. I would say my children have a sense of commitment, but mm-hmm. but they haven't followed in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, they don't have to.
They don't have to.
There was a kind of compulsion.
Yeah, there was a compulsion, and also there was an ease about that time, because we all knew we could come back to the States and get jobs.
Mm-hmm.
We all figured we could pick up our education or whatever we were doing after we came back mm-hmm. and continue, and I don't think there's that feeling now, that if you take your hand off the rudder at this point, you can't come back, and I think that inhibits, you know, people.
And it may explain the youth's seeming conservatism as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're essentially our parents. They're depression-era kids living through their own sense of limited resources, where we grew up in a generation where everything was unlimited. The power was so available.
Yeah. I think that they have diminished sense of freedom, definitely.
And they blame us.
Do they?
Well, not them, but the political leaders that are appealing to them seem to want to blame any of the problems they have actually on the profligate spending of the 60s or something like that, forgetting that, of course...
Oh, well, it was the 80s.
Well, yes, and, but the point is that both Democrats and Republicans voted for all those bills or we wouldn't have them.
Mm-hmm.
They say, well, anyway. Yeah. It's amazing. I don't want to leave any key issue out here, but as you look back at that IBS experience, you said that it seems very personally valuable to you. Do you know what's going on in IBS today, the way they're operating today?
I do see the newsletter. So I seems like it's from their own description sounds very very meaningful and significant. And also pretty inspiring. Yeah.
Do you contribute to IBS?
I'm not in a position to contribute at the moment.
I think this brings an end to our most fascinating talk. I will follow up some of these issues and send you